Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to Tom and Jim's Awesome Real Estate Adventure. Tom, I'm excited about this one. I know I say it every week, but this time I mean it.
Yeah, you may not recognize his face or his name, but this man has touched your life in one way or another.
Carlos Bucaris. He's the executive director of Manatee Seaport, yes. Right down the road.
Yes.
This is the port, the Manatee Port. We might know it off Piney Point and 41.
Yes.
Thanks for being here this morning. What a pleasure. What an honor. There's so much to cover and so much that I don't know, and there's a lot to learn. So thanks for being here this morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, good. Manatee Seaport, the closest U.S. deep water port north of the Panama Canal, correct?
Correct. We hold that record. So, you know, the Panama Canal has just been expanded a few years ago. So the idea is that bigger ships, more cargo, will be able to come through. And being the closest essentially means savings and money to the shipping lines that come to the port.
So when we talk about deep water, what are we talking about? How deep is the water?
Okay, so a deep water seaport has to have at least 35 feet of water underneath the port itself. And we have over 40 feet of water, able to handle just about probably 95% of all the ships in the world.
Tom, Seaport Manatee has I read this on the internet, so I know it's true, a $5.1 billion local economic impact. Is that right?
Yes. And so it's an econometric model. It's developed based on the commodities and the value of the commodities we bring in and the number of jobs it creates too. Because every time we bring in something, someone has to touch it, and someone has to bring it in, drive it, process it, put it on a shelf, put it in a gas tank. So all of those jobs that are related to and the economic impact, it's the multiplier. For example, last year, the port brought through approximately $400 million in appliances. Now, we're not using them at the port, and that's the gross, right?
Yeah.
We are delivering it to the buyers that bring in the appliances that go in the houses that you sell.
So 5.1 billion with a B. How many employees are we talking
about?
Very few.
The port has a total of 100 employees, less than 100 employees actually. And the facility is 1,100, acres inside the fence. And so we are essentially leasing space to shipping companies and terminal operators that then hire employees to unload the ships and load the ships.
So is this county owned, is this Manatee County owned, or is it an authority like SRQ would be the airport authority?
Correct. No, the port is a dependent special district, which is a designation under the Florida code that designates a port authority, which it is.
Okay.
And by using the same commissioners as the county has. However, they're meeting under different legal framework, and they're also with their separate attorney advising them on the laws and issues of a seaport.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different hat. It's a very different hat because essentially the port being, not taxing anyone, and not taking any money from any other special funds, is able to generate all these jobs without costing the county a penny. In fact, the businesses that are port related, that bring in money, pay about $4 million a year to the county coffers of the taxes, the property taxes that they owe. However, these companies would not be here, such as Air Products, if it weren't because the port is right across the street.
So you talked about regulations, mm-hmm. And I'm sure where you are, everybody's watching. I mean, we probably have, the Coast Guard, heard about that, probably TSA.
Yes.
Who else
TSA,
knows?
Homeland Security, USDA. We bring in all of the orange juice you drink, right? So what happens, there's a Food Safety Act, and the Food Safety Act says we don't want any foreign nation putting in anything dangerous in that orange juice. Where does the orange juice come from? Brazil. So when we bring in the orange juice, there's a USDA inspector, several, testing every gallon of orange juice that comes in. And we bring in millions of gallons. Okay?
Of orange juice.
Of orange juice. Millions of gallons. 40 million pineapples.
Wow.
1.1 billion bananas. Okay? So the port itself and the jobs that it is able to have, you know, supplies way further than the state of Florida even.
So has anyone ever asked you about the oranges and the tomatoes, perhaps, mm-hmm. that we import? Mm-hmm. And how much do we export of oranges? This is Manatee County, man, the largest producer of orange groves at one time.
Yes, that's true. What's happened is that the weather and the opportunity to sell the land for other purposes has reduced the Florida crop from maybe as high as, don't quote me on this, but 240 million boxes at its height, able to produce that, to less than 16 million boxes. Mm. So by far, Florida has always been the preferred location for developing the fruit. But if the growers in Florida are not doing it, and you want to have some orange juice, we have to bring it in. And so we bring in millions of gallons of juice from Brazil, as an example, and from Mexico.
Well, I'm sure somebody's asked you that before.
Essentially, you know, it's you know, we don't make the things you buy. You know, we don't sell the things you buy. We just try to make it better.
Ship it. Yeah.
We ship it in and out.
Tell me about some of the equipment at the port. I've never been there. I can't wait to maybe Tom and I just drive by there on Sunday when we're out driving around, mm-hmm. I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Tell me about some of the equipment, the docks and the cranes, and right. because I can see them from miles away.
So the port is able to handle every type of ship there is, okay? And so ports are diversified, and the infrastructure related to that handling of those ships is the responsibility of the port. So building a dock, okay, an extension of a dock, okay, today, it's going to probably cost us $50 million. Okay? And that's without any other, you know, support from anybody. So we need to make $50 million to build a $50 million dock to put in that ship that can then bring in the cargo that goes right to the warehouse.
Okay.
Cranes to unload the ships. Reach stackers, which are essentially top lifts that can go and pick up the containers and move them around the port. That's $1 million, you know, each. Now, we don't operate those. So we do requests for proposals from companies between them and the shipping line to do that on our land. That's why we only have 100 employees, because we run security. Security has to be ours by law. Very tight security. No one can get in and out of the port without the port knowing who they are and where they're coming from, for obvious reasons. And we do the administrative tasks of making sure that those terminal operators are doing their job as they're supposed to by their contract. But we don't actually run the forklifts, and we don't, you know, load the containers, and we don't unload the ships. There are companies at the port who do that.
So how about the pilots? That's something that we were talking about earlier. The pilots of those ships, is that... Who operates that? Is it the liner, the shipping company?
So the, you know, by law, any ship coming in has to take on a state of Florida pilot, in this case, the Tampa Bay pilots. So at Egmont Key, which is the pilot right. station, the pilot gets on the ship and brings it into whatever facility in Tampa Bay it's supposed to go to. So the pilot's responsible for bringing it in. And the pilot's responsible for bringing it out.
Because they know the bay. They know what's out there.
They know the bay. They know all the nooks and crannies. So there's no issue, you know, with any hitting any, you know, any hard surface that then, you know, has a problem with the ship. And so as a result, the pilots are by law mandated and obliged and the responsibility to bring in the ships.
Interesting.
Okay, one more thing. Tell us about what happens during the storm, during a hurricane. Okay, mm-hmm. I mean, you guys close up and everybody goes home to their families and
they... We don't. We stay. We stay. We stay with essential personnel. So during a storm, the captain of the port, which is the Coast Guard, depending on the condition, will order all ships to leave the port and search for safe haven. Go north, go south. You're not staying at the port. Why? Because if it sinks at the port, we have a big problem.
Okay.
So ships are ordered by the captain to leave the port.
And they go where?
And they can go anywhere where they could be safely, let's say, anchored. Anywhere. So depending on the weather, right? So the captain is responsible for taking the ship out. Actually, the pilot comes on to Egmont Key and then waves goodbye to the ship. Then, during the storm, before the storm, all of the equipment at the port that can fly around is secured and tied down. Then we send all the non-essential personnel home. You know, anybody in engineering, anything we're not going to need. And then the port hunkers down for the storm. We have all the security people there because itself the gates. If you want to come into the gate through the port and you have a lot, you know, you have the permit to go through, you can do it literally, you know, 24/7 during the year. And during a storm, the port's gates never closed. Now, if you could not drive to the port, that's different.
Right.
But if you drove to the port, you wanted to get in, you could get in through the storm. After the storm, the Coast Guard takes the soundings to make sure that they clear the port in the event there are some obstructions to the channel. You know, any debris or something that would be a hazard to navigation.
I understand.
And as soon as they clear us, you know, the ships come right in.
We were talking earlier about a fuel supply and how that works and to the tanker trucks. Tell us again about that.
And so the port is a fuel terminal handled by a company by the name of Transmontane. Imagine, you know, a large the gas station to the tanker trucks that bring the gas to your gas station, right? It's an equivalent gas station. So this fuel comes in by ship, gets put on those tanks by this company, and then the tanker trucks that deliver to your local gas station come in and fill up as if you were filling up your car at the local, you know, gas facility.
Mm-hmm.
They swipe their card, they connect the hose to the tank, 8,400 gallons, they fill in about 15, 20 minutes, they head out of the port, go to the station, drop the entire fuel supply, come right back to the port, and they're doing that 24/7. So it is a really fantastic, if you would, fantastic logistics machine that makes sure that no one runs out of fuel.
So even when a storm is approaching, we still have fuel as a priority.
Fuel, I think, is the top priority, I think, for one of the top priorities for the state and the port in terms of, you know, making sure that, you know, prior to the storm, during the storm or after the storm, that you can get to where you're supposed to go.
Interesting. Makes sense. Things you never think about.
So tell me about environmental issues that you may have or projects that you may have. You know, when I drive down Piney Point Road every now and then, I see a pile of whatever out front. I saw a pile of neon green something one time, and I thought, well, that doesn't look right. But actually, and then the next time, 2 days later, it's gone, and there's something else in that pile out in front of the port.
So the yellow pile was sulfur. And sulfur is used for as part of the recipe for fertilizers, and that was, you know, Mosaic driven cargo. So we don't buy anything and we don't sell anything. So a company would say, you know, for example, following up on the scrap metal, we can't eat it, we can't bury it, and so companies sell the scrap to the scrap yard at the port. It gets shredded, depending on the use, gets put on a ship and shipped out of the country. It does not have to go to a landfill. It's a great model. So we are essentially exporting that material that otherwise would have to be buried somewhere, which we don't want to another country where it's turned into rebar that gets shipped back so the developers can put it in the houses that you're going to be selling.
Comes full circle.
See?
Comes full circle. And we don't have to, again, worry about, you know, the environmental impacts of like burying a, you know, not having a car in the ground,
yeah,
even if it's shredded,
mm-hmm,
or any other metal after storms. You know, you have a lot of metal that and from homes that can also be reprocessed. So they're a metal processor and shipping it back as rebar.
So as I drive by the port, also I see other companies. Obviously, they support the port, or they may utilize the port. That I mean, that whole area in that port area is just, you know, is growing up. And now with Moccasin Wallow Road, that extension being widened, even there's more activity at the port, I'm sure.
Yeah, the ports grow by the demand of the consumer growth. You know, there are ports that have shrunk. If everybody moves, for example, you know, ports in the Northeast of the U.S. that, you know, have shrinking populations, you know, import less by design. We, on the other hand, need to keep up with the growth of the homes and the residents that you all are selling, because, you know, you can't do it with the same amount of fuel or the same amount of fruits and vegetables or orange juice. We were doing it 25 years ago. So ports grow by the demand of the consumer. We are the only port that's ever going to be built on the west coast of Florida. And so the growth of the port is critical to maintaining that growing population, you know, being able to purchase the services and products and commodities and food that they want to buy.
Any new products coming to the port?
Yes, there are, but they come in different, so for example, different types of commodities. We saw a lot of plywood coming in.
How about that?
That was right. That was logical. Again, very much built around for the construction industry and the people that you put in and the residential construction and the, you know, the buyers of those homes. Because the port doesn't buy anything. Again, the orange juice, who's buying it? Those residents.
Consumers.
It's consumer driven. And so that's what the port fulfills. So as the consumers grow and the population grows, the port is seeing more a variety of different products because, you know, the closest point to where it's supposed to be delivered is always the most logical, instead of driving something from Savannah or Miami to a consumer right here in Manatee County.
I can't imagine the pressures that you have with dealing with all this, and there's just so many important aspects of what you deal with every day, and you're just a smooth person to come in and talk to. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Great job. One more question, final question, I promise. Tell us about the International Trade Port out here on 301 and I-75. There's all these warehouses out there. That's the International Trade Port. Is that you?
No, that isn't us.
But it says International
Port. Yeah, port does not have a copyright.
Okay.
You know, but however, I think it follows that the warehousing happening, and one of the companies there, for example, you know, is tied to imported products, imported commodities.
Okay.
And so, you know, we love the word port in any shape, form, or size.
All right.
And the port, you know, these commodities that come in before they go maybe to the trade port, come through the port itself on their way to the trade port, because we're not the final facility for storage.
Just implications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Carlos, thank you again, my friend. Thanks for coming in. Great job.
Pleasure.
Thank you. And if you like what you hear, please hit the like and share button at the bottom, and then let everybody else know what you're seeing and hearing on the Tom and Jim podcast.
Great stuff. Everybody, thanks for watching. We'll see you next time.